All right, that's a little bit of buffer window there, and welcome to Rethinking. We're back again. I said it last time in that little 30-minute snippet about Zach's life.
Yeah.
That if you didn't listen to it, you're not a cool person because
shame on you.
Deep on Zach's new life, and you should be interested in Zach. I know everybody's here to listen to me. Hi, Mom. But you should be interested in Zach, too. He's a good guy. And he definitely bought the mic that I'm not using right now.
With the money that we made from our advertising and sponsors.
Yeah. Shout out Jeff Foxworthy. Shout out Golden Growl. So I'm Josh, here with Zach, as always.
Hi.
And Zach, live from Michigan. Zach, how's the weather out there?
It was 55 and sunny today. Most of the snow has melted, and we were on the beach, and I was playing wiffle ball with the kids.
Hmm. Yep, beach at 55 degrees. You're definitely in Michigan.
And it felt warm.
Amazing. So we're going to get right back heavy into it. High-quality, rethinking stuff. And we're going to talk about fear.
I'm already afraid.
You should be afraid. Because you have this, like,
of the dark?
You have this big, important megachurch deal that you're at now. All right, you're some sort of shady mercenary pastor for a 5,000-person megachurch. You go on these shady trips outside of the country for 3 weeks at a time. You know, I don't want to put your business out there, but, you know, for a guy who takes shady month and a half trips to Africa and the Middle East once a year, I'm not going to say anything else because I'm afraid somebody will find me dead in my car tomorrow.
Hey, if anyone out there is listening, this would make a good film script or, you know, book series. Hi, Mom. If you ever wanted to write this.
You're just halfway through the podcast when Zach goes, Code Omega. Oh, no. So fear is an interesting topic because we're not trying to look at fear just in the sense of we're not trying to go into physiological fear and we're not looking at phobias. But it seems like fear mongering, the use of fear to motivate people, is something that gets selectively called out in our culture. And one of the things I want to break down, one of the things I want to deconstruct or rethink today, hashtag rethinking podcast, is the fact that it seems like if you go back in our history as a country, you know, fear has been the strongest and or the primary motivating factor for us culturally, spiritually, politically, you know, and so that's something that I really want to dive into and see if we can kind of rethink the way that we are motivated by media, the way we're motivated politically by those in power, and the way we're motivated spiritually as well, and whether or not doing that via fear is, is a really harmful thing.
Yeah, it's a fascinating subject. I think there are like three, I guess from my perspective, and just also thinking biblically and being somewhat familiar with the, you know, Hebrew and Christian scriptures, there are at least three basic motivators of human beings, and they kind of are introduced in Genesis, you know, so at the beginning of the Bible, you know, chapter 2 and 3, you know, that part of the story. The first human beings are in the garden, and that's where we're kind of introduced to consequences of human decision making being guilt, fear, and shame. So at like a very basic human level, these are the three primary, or at least three of the major primary motivators of human beings, guilt, fear, and shame. And for whatever reason, like, In our society, you know, the United States, we are historically primarily motivated by fear. It's sort of like our trigger or our trigger word.
Hashtag triggered.
Hashtag triggered. So, you know, other societies on the planet, you know, might be more shame-based. you know, cultures or even guilt may be a way, you know, to manipulate and motivate people either for better or worse. But for whatever reason, our relationship here in the United States to fear is like a very special relationship to us. Like so much of our culture has to do with our relationship to fear. I mean, like just anxiety, the way that we medicate and self-medicate ourselves here in the United States, it's all, you know, like connected, at least from my viewpoint, you know, to like this basic human experience of fear and anxiety and everything associated with it.
It's funny that you said, you know, three primary motivators: guilt, shame, and fear. And there's nothing good in there. Like, what are our good motivators? What are the good things that motivate us to take action? And, you know, because the New Testament is sunshine and butterflies, you know, and,
well,
you know,
except for the hero gets, you know, slaughtered.
Yeah, but he comes back. Like, sorry to ruin the sequel for you. Yeah, sorry to ruin the sequel for you, but like, yeah. So, you know, that's very Rollins of you, right? It's, you know, the atheistic core of Christianity is or the nihilistic core of Christianity is that Jesus is dead for 3 days and nobody knows that he's going to come back, right? And then bam, he drops his second solo album and everybody's like, whoa, that shit was hot, you know. But and Revelation's kind of a bummer too. So like, but for the most part, comparatively, Old Testament is very guilt, shame, and fear, E. And the New Testament is much more like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be stoning this hooker. Like, maybe we should be like, try and be cool, you know, and help people, and we can find motivation and sustain ourselves spiritually through just being decent and not just being afraid of stuff, right?
Yeah. But
culturally, we really don't get that, though. We've never gotten that American culture. I mean, one of the things is we were discussing this, you know, and we've discussed it in the past. Our good friend, the preacher from the 18th century America's, Jonathan Stewart, the host of The Daily Show.
Yeah, no, I think it was Jonathan Edwards that ran for vice president.
Oh, Jonathan Edwards, who cheated on his cancer-stricken wife. Yeah, so yeah, Jonathan Edwards, preacher in colonial America, led this kind of spiritual revolution in the colonies, and he did it primarily through convincing people that God was dangling them above a fireplace, right?
Like, quite literally, yes.
Yeah, like, literally, that was the imagery. Sinners in the hands of an angry God. Go give it a read. It's very, it's very, very evangelical. it would play great at Lakewood. Could you imagine Joel Osteen delivering Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God?
It sounds like a meme video.
Just if you put it in front of him and didn't tell him what it was, and you just thought it was a sermon about like prosperity and like God's gonna make you rich if you make me rich, and then he just starts reading. It's like, God is holding you. You are insects in his hand, dangled above the fiery precipice of hell. And he's just like, I think there's something wrong with my teleprompter. Okay, I'm sorry. So I realized that was much funnier to me than it was to you, but you've been out of Houston too long already that Joel Osteen isn't a big target to you.
Who? Never heard of him.
Never heard of the guy. Never heard of him. you pull in the Eric Bledsoe there. Terry Rozier, I don't know who that is, even though I've been staring at the back of his jersey as he torched me for 33 tonight. So, all right. Hashtag NBA. So in all seriousness, though, so, you know, from the very start of our culture as a nation, not only politically, you know, you see in the imagery surrounding our founding fathers and the way that they responded to British colonial rule, you know, give me liberty or give me death. The redcoats are coming. The redcoats are coming. You know, stand ready, men. Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. And like all of this imagery surrounding the plucky American colonists fighting the giant British Empire was, you know, it's very motivating people based on fear. Like they're coming to take your stuff. They're taxing tea. We don't have Coke yet, so tea is like the only decent thing we have to drink.
It's not even sweet yet.
Yeah, like, I mean, it's, you know, so they're going to keep taxing stuff. They're going to keep taking away your hard-earned money. We have to fight them or else they're going to take everything from you. And from that propelled us into, you can see that theme kind of resurface as a strong motivating factor throughout basically every age of our country to date. And it seems like it's especially prevalent now. It seems like no matter which element of our culture you turn to, whether it's politic or music or finances or anything, religion, the primary driving factor is a scarcity mindset or fear or trying to convince you that if you don't take action for or against something, something bad will happen to you.
Yes, it is the fascination trigger that hashtag triggered that.
Hashtag triggered.
You know, that motivates us. You could even argue that, you know, fear is what was sort of the underlying emotional experience that led to sort of, you know, the marginalization and even, you know, murder, genocide, whatever, of First Nations people. Slavery in America was, you know, driven by this emotion.
When you say First Nations people, break that down for
Native Americans.
There you go.
That would be another way to say. Slavery in the United States, the primary motivation, you know, or underlying cause is fear. You know, people that are different than us, cultural expressions that are different. You know, there's just an unfamiliarity with, the way people live in and experience the world, the different ways people talk and relate to one another within their, you know, family structures and communities. And, you know, I mean, even now it plays out in a city, even a small city, like you can't go to that neighborhood, you know, you never go by yourself at night in that neighborhood, or
don't cross the railroad tracks.
Yeah. Don't go. You don't want your kids going to that school. You know, you got to send them over here and pay extra money, you know, or you got to live in this neighborhood so your kids go to this school. And,
it's funny. The type of fear triggers that you mentioned there, very strongly indicate what culture you and I are immersed in, right? You know, that idea, like the things that you just brought up that you're experiencing kind of on a city level, those fears are very much middle class fears.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, so like, and to be properly introspective on that, like, you know, we're talking about fear being a motivator, and the fears that we're talking about are, you know, oh, well, you don't want your child to go to that school. They might get into fights or they're not going to get the education that you're looking for. Whereas if you belong to a different social class within our country or within that city, maybe even 5 minutes or 5 miles away from you, it would be your child has to go to that school, even though you don't want them to. What you don't want them to do is you don't want them to walk to school alone because they'll get shot.
Yeah.
You know? And so it's just interesting. And I want to steal your thunder. I'm going to yank your thunder away from you, preacher. All right. And I'm going to throw down some Bible into this.
Awesome.
All right. If you'll all flip in your Bibles, if you didn't bring a Bible today, you're a heathen and we're going to shame you right out of the building. Or you can go to the back table next to the coffee and donuts and you can purchase a Bible for a small donation, $29.95, hardcover only. All right.
Or download the Bible.org app on your iPhone.
Oh, God. So the way that ads are run nowadays, I'm just waiting for the moment when you download that Bible app, that free Bible app that runs ads, and it's running Google ads, but you're nasty, so you've just been looking at Pino. So you're getting like Google targeted ads on your Bible app, but they're totally inappropriate.
That is...
because that's how advertising works now. So Bible app developers, be careful who you use as your ad engines.
That is hilarious.
Okay. All right. So, all right, bringing it back to the Bible. If you look at the book of Mark, all right, chapter 4, you know where I'm going with this?
Go ahead.
All right. So in the verse 30 to 40 range somewhere, Jesus takes his disciples out on the boat, right? And it's cool, man. Like, you're like, hey, we have the opportunity to go cruising with Jesus. We're like, most of us are fishermen anyway, so we're cool with this. And they're out and the winds pick up and it gets really crazy. And that's when the infamous, like, Jesus is walking on the water thing, right?
Yeah. And I actually was there just not too many moons ago.
You were there
on a boat and on the Sea of Galilee.
Like, yeah.
2 months ago.
Did you walk on the water?
No, I was too afraid to get out of the boat.
Why do you have no faith, Zach? Why are you still afraid?
But
Jesus
had
calmed the winds for you.
It was a very smooth ride the day that I was out there on the water. But I did see the valley. There's a valley in between these two kind of ranges, and it's kind of serves as like a wind tunnel, like kind of a natural wind tunnel, which is why the wind and waves could potentially pick up in a lake like the sea. They call it a sea, but it's really a lake.
Okay. I dig it. So the story for as it's written, all right, as it's told, is that Jesus takes the disciples out onto a boat. There's a bad storm. The disciples are afraid. They keep waking up Jesus. He's just trying to catch some Z's. And finally he goes out and he walks on the water and he calms the wind and nobody wants to follow him walking out of the water, which, by the way, huge. Like, you get the opportunity to play video game cheat codes in real life, and you got Jesus standing right in front of you. Huge opportunity missed.
Okay, like, hold on. Which story is this from Mark 4? Do you actually have it open?
I have it open. Is this the right one?
There's two different stories. There's one where he's in the boat and they want him to calm the waves. There's another one where he walks from the shoreline to them in the boat. It's two different stories.
Okay, this is the one where they're in the boat and he's calming the wind.
Okay. So they wake him up.
So they wake him up. All right. So sorry, I flipped it around. So he walks first, or does he walk after?
I think it's just two different experiences. They
went cruising with Jesus twice.
So they were fishermen, right? And you would always fish at night. That's when you fish. So you never fish during the day, really. The fish come out at night. The fish come out at night. The fish come out.
Okay, great. I like it. I dig it. So the story that I'm going for is Jesus calming the wind, right?
Got it.
And everybody's still afraid.
Yes.
And he looks at him and he says, "Why are you still afraid? You know, do you still not have faith in what's going on?" And so the comparison that I want to make, right, is like, we talk about America all the time as being, or I say we, you know, politically, culturally, secularly, spiritually, religiously, everybody recognizes America as this place that's better to be than everywhere else, right? Like, historically. Now, maybe people's opinions are swaying a little bit, but for the most part, we recognize that America is safer, is wealthier, is more powerful, has better opportunity. The winds are calm in America. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah.
Kind of in the same way that like, you know, we were talking about the classes being different. You know, we were talking about, you know, how cities are used to motivate fear within us. And, you know, for some of us, it's, oh, I want my kids to go to the right school. And for some of us, it's, you know, I don't want my kid to get shot. So, you know, I feel like there's something there, right?
Yeah. That'll preach. About
the winds are calm, you know, but from a religious perspective, from a spiritual perspective, or even just from a secular perspective, here you are living in this much better, great place. Why are you still afraid? Like, why is fear the easiest motivator for you when you're living this charmed life in one way or another? Go, Zach.
I think, you know, okay, here's what comes to my mind is that sometimes, like in a very pragmatic and just like very like practical relational way, like we develop defense mechanisms. We develop like a habit of response and posture based on what has happened in the past, like, or what we may even through our own family or culture sort of like inherit unconscious beliefs and behaviors, and the source or the cause or the root of those beliefs or behaviors could potentially be fear. So I'm trying to think of a different example than the one that comes to my mind, but like think about like someone who's maybe you know, think about someone who maybe has they were in a physically abusive relationship, right, with their partner, and they somehow, you know, ended that relationship, or you know, fled that relationship, or you know, somehow got out of that relationship, and at some point in, you know, later, sometime later, they were in a new relationship, and they still relate to the new person from a place of fear and anxiety and sort of self-protection. Does that make sense? Do you see where I'm going with this?
I see where you're going with that, but it seems like in American culture, a more appropriate metaphor would be somebody who sees someone in that abusive relationship and then projects that fear of that relationship onto their own partner.
Yeah.
You know what? Because
you better take this action or otherwise that could be you.
Yeah. Scarcity mindset and, or, you know, that's most of what we see. I mean, you see it in jingoist rhetoric. You see it in, you know, like jingoist political rhetoric where you see, these other people have it worse than us. So they're going to try and make our life like theirs. You know, yeah. these immigrants or these other, you know, insert enemy nation here, or this religious or political subgroup here, or this political opposition here. They are trying to make our country like this country. My favorite one is socialists. These socialists are trying to turn us into some crazy socialist propaganda. I mean, socialism isn't exactly a pervasively powerful force. Even if it was, I mean, you're talking about a political ideology. You're not talking about the spawn of Satan. You know, like, I mean, at the worst, you balance out political ideology within political structure. Like, that's how politic works. But the same thing spiritually, religiously, right, is like you threaten people with hell, knowing full well that these people, you're threatening them with something they have no concept of being able to experience, because hell is a you know, if hell is to be believed as existing in the way that evangelicals tend to describe it, it is unimaginable awfulness, right?
Yeah.
That regardless of whatever pain or suffering or tragedy that people have been through, they still have no concept of hell. Hashtag Sam Neill, shout out for Event Horizon. All right. But so, you know, you're not talking about people being afraid of something coming back for them that they've experienced already, because I would consider that a much more noble motivator. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It seems like a much more reasonable motivator to be, for instance, born into squalor, come out of squalor, and make comfort, make money, make success for yourself, and then have a fear of returning to squalor. That, to me, is more noble or a more reasonable motivator than to have been born into relative wealth and comfort, spend your entire life experiencing relative wealth and comfort, and then be motivated by others threatening you that you would potentially lose your wealth and comfort with a lifestyle that you have no concept of experiencing.
Yeah. Well, you know, going back to that metaphor, I mean, maybe that I was using, like, maybe rather than, maybe in more instances throughout history than not, we would be more likened to the oppressor, you know, in the versus the one who is oppressed, you know. And so there's some, you know, power. There's some power and authority in playing that role, that of creating the fear, in a sense, within the other, versus being afraid. So being the one who is the cause of fear, I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say, actually, but...
Well, I mean, certainly there's an element...
It depends on who we polled, who we asked this question to, because, you know, I was talking about it from the perspective of, like, you know, someone who's been a victim, right?
Yeah.
But, like... You know, there are probably, you know, depending on who we ask that question to, they may see the dominant Western culture, middle class, upper class of the United States as being part of the problem of being the oppressor and the one who causes fear.
I guess the question that you have to ask is on a spiritual level or on the level of human to human relation, because we believe that there is power in human interaction. Everybody believes that at some level or another, whether it's a religious thing, whether it's a humanist thing, whether it's a social thing, there is power in people coming together, whether it's just a sheer reality thing, is the idea that people coming together can do great and or terrible things, right?
Sure.
And so the question is if you have oppressive natures, or if you have oppressive actions within an element of your culture, how much does that bleed over into the rest, right? Mm-hmm. So looking at America from its conception, slavery was a very prominent thing in America. We can dress it up however we want, and we can let ourselves be swayed in one way or another by what we perceive to be somebody else's political agendas, but the sheer historical fact is that the early economies and power of this country were bolstered and propelled forward by the use of slaves, and slavery being the pervasive evil that it is as a concept, that some people are worth less than others, being present at the very conception of our country, it has to have bled out into the other elements of our culture and caused harm, you know, caused harm to our values, caused harm to our religion, caused harm to our spirituality, caused harm to our interpersonal relationships, not just with the oppressed peoples, but with each other as well. The way that we interact with minorities, the way we interact with women, the way we interact with other men, the way we interact with other whites, whoever, right? And And so there has to be harm done there. And so can we find the roots of fear's effectiveness in motivating us in those oppressive relationships? Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it definitely connects with where I was trying to go. It seems difficult to deconstruct because, you know, like I think even in my own life, like fear motivates me to make a lot of my decisions, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like there's a lot, you know, in having a family, things like, you know, like a car, like I have insurance on the car. Like, why do I have insurance? Cause I'm afraid that, you know, I could wreck the car and then, you know, owe a lot of money still, you know?
Yeah.
Or, you know, I like everything that I do in a lot of ways in my own life is motivated by just my own anxieties.
I guess the question though, so the insurance thing is very interesting. Because I don't necessarily think of having insurance on something as being a fear-based action. And, you know, because to me, you don't have to be afraid of bad things happening to be prepared for bad things to happen. And so this is an interesting crossroads, right? Is it, you know, because the question that we ask there is, does simply taking action to prevent a bad thing or to ease the potential for a bad thing, does that constitute a fear decision? Or is it only when you let that fear manipulate or control your actions on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. I mean, you know, the fact is that, you know, for me, like what drives the decision, is it facts or is it fear, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, I guess the fact is that, you know, chances are if you drive a car enough, for long enough and for far enough, that chances are you're going to blow a tire out. You're going to get in a fender bender or whatever, you know, and so you're you know, you have insurance, I guess, to offset that event, you know, when it happens, because it's likely that it will if you spend enough time behind the wheel of a car, you know. So that is the fact. So maybe that decision, you know, to have insurance is not motivated as much by fear as it is by the fact that, you know, the potential that the worst could happen, you know?
Yeah. And certainly it's a, you know, there's not a firm line there because, you know, other people can use facts that maybe aren't statistically relevant to justify fear-based choices. Right. And in some cases even call them brave choices, which is a really interesting paradigm to get into, right? Is, let's take a look at gun ownership, right? I own a gun. You know, I keep a gun in the house. It's a decision that I've made for my own protection because I believe that there is a chance that I would have to use that gun to defend myself in my own house. That is a fear response to me because what that's saying is, what I'm ultimately saying to myself is, I am afraid enough of losing of the very small chance that I would have of losing my things and or my life, the life of my loved ones. I'm afraid enough of that I'm going to put myself directly in the position to take another person's life away from them in order to maintain those things, right?
Check what you have or what you own or what matters to you.
Yeah, that to me, that is a fear decision. You know, and not even necessarily one I'm gonna sit here and defend, right? It's just it is a decision that I have made. And so it's interesting to deconstruct that because statistically, you know, I don't have numbers I don't have statistical numbers to support the idea that my house could be broken into. I don't have statistics to support that my population in my area, my age group, my gender, my socioeconomic status, any of those things, that there are any metrics or indicators to suggest that I am prone to being a victim of crime in my own home, right?
Yeah.
I have nothing to base that on other than the idea that I have somewhere in my head planted by someone or something that my home could fall victim to crime and that gun is going to protect me. And that's pervasive.
Yeah, like, so it's almost like it's an underlying feeling that you have. Like, but where does that feeling come from?
Yeah, and if we talked about, you know, elements of, you know, elements of fear bleeding over into the entire culture, you know, elements of oppression bleeding over into the entire culture, how much does that fear that causes me to own a gun bleed over into and affect the rest of my decisions? You know, is that fear pervasive in that way? Does that affect me in other ways that prevent me from being as kind as I could be, or as charitable as I could be, or as generous as I could be, or as compassionate as I could be? Does it affect the way I vote? Does it affect the way I behave towards people on a daily basis? Does it affect what I do with my money? Does it affect what I do with my life choices? It's something that I don't think people think or rethink or re-rethink.
I agree with you. I mean, I think it comes down to, you know, most people, and I don't in any way think of that I'm exempt from this. We are driven by our feelings and our fears, and that our feelings and our fears are what dominate our decision-making at, generally speaking, a subconscious level. You know, like it's kind of like it's kind of like intuitive in a sense, like we just like our mode of being comes from a underlying feeling of just that is based on fear, our fears. But like, where do those fears come from? Are we born with those? Do we learn those? Is it nature? You know, is it sort of, are those fears inherited into our subconscious, or are they developed over time and nurtured into us through our relationships?
I would say
something. I
100% believe that they are, that is, those fears are not something that we are born with, but that we can see fear used in our culture, in our interpersonal relationships, in our media, in advertising, in politics, in all of these different places to motivate us, but that all of those things have gotten so overwhelming and so loud and constantly surrounding us that we don't even recognize it at this point, not to mention the fact that it's been the primary motivator in our country for 200 and something years. So how would we even realize it?
You know? Like, part of our comfort zone now is to be afraid. Like, yeah. We actually like pay money to become more afraid.
You could like go to a horror movie, you know,
like Halloween is like, you know, like it's like a, probably like $1 billion industry, you know,
to be made afraid or just to get free candy.
I don't know, both probably.
So from your perspective, from a spiritual perspective, from a religious perspective, part of what really bothers me about the fear engine is that the entity that I see as potentially being the standout of the fear cycle, the fear engine in the fear cycle, which is like a motorcycle with a bunch of wheels. All right.
Something, I'm picturing something from Mad Max.
Yeah. It's, you know, would be faith, like, would be religion, would be spirituality of any sort. you know, not even a specific religion, but just a belief in a higher power or a higher purpose, and the structure by which to further that belief and turn it into action towards that higher purpose, right? But unfortunately, I feel like in today's culture, we see much more of religious institutions feeding into that fear through politic or even through their own teachings. Like, what are your thoughts there?
So it's interesting.
I told you I was going to get you fired. I was going to get you to say something. Here it comes.
No, I can't say everything that I could say, but it is interesting that that a lot of religious decisions, you know, organizational decisions that happen for within religious entities, churches, you know, just speaking from a plainly an evangelical, you know, Christian perspective, is driven by fear, you know, like the fear of not bringing in enough, you know, money, the fear of, you know, not meeting people's spiritual needs and then being, you know, somewhat accountable or liable or responsible for them, you know, going the wrong direction, ending up in the wrong place, you know, whatever. The fear of, you know, upsetting someone, or, you know, the fear of changing the way that we've always done things. Just so, you know, you're not allowed to say that. You're not allowed to wear that. You can't go to that place. You can't hang out with those people. You know, you can't watch that. You know, you can't consume that.
Words straight out of the Pharisee's mouth.
So, you know, and then the whole idea about the afterlife and, you know, going somewhere that you've never seen before, you know, all of this stuff is definitely grounded in fear, at least in the way that the public relations, you know, markets it.
Church PR department.
Yeah. So you know, there's different ways to interpret a lot of what the Bible says. There's different ways to understand it. For yourself and to apply it in your life. But generally speaking, the dominant culture of evangelical Christianity is based around, is, you know, and profits from fear. So I recognize that. The weird thing is that so many times over and over again in the Bible, you know, like God speaking in quotation marks is like, do not be afraid. Didn't I tell you to not fear? You know, like just over and over again throughout the Old Testament.
You said something there that I just want to highlight is God speaking in quotation marks in the Bible, which is, I don't want that to be glossed over, because that's an important concept that I think that maybe people gloss over too much, is that there are parts of the Bible, whether you believe it to be true or truer than true, or if you don't believe it at all, but whatever. But there are parts of the story that are part of the story. And then there are parts of the story where God is literally supposed to be speaking in one way or another. And in any narrative, you have the fluff, all right, around the descriptor. And, you know, if you're reading Dickens, and he's going to tell you every little freaking thing, right? And then you have the dialogue that propels the story, and the, you know, the action, you know, that happens in descriptors around helps you form the picture. But at the end of the day, most stories, I feel like, are driven forward by characters looking at each other and saying things. And that's where the meat and that's where the substance is, especially in today's society where, you know, you have movies and actors are so prominent, right? And so, you know, the fact that God is speaking these things directly, these are God's lines in the script. This is the line that's going to get God the Oscar. Shout out Kobe Bryant. So, sorry. So go ahead. So God speaks in the Bible, and so often the things that he says are, do not be afraid.
Yeah, I mean, that's well said, by the way. But I think when you just plainly read the Bible, I mean, you know, that you can't deny, you know, that there are points where it does seem like, you know, people were afraid of God. You know, there's this idea of like fear and trembling that kind of comes through. And there are moments like where people have some experience of God and it's like they die, you know, right there on the ground. And there are, you know, parts or stories of the Bible where, you know, God is seen to be executing justice or whatever, you know. But I think that it all of that stuff is outweighed by like God in like an authentic relationship with a human being, whether that's Moses or Abram or Joshua or David or
shout out Joshua,
Jesus himself, you know, like or communicating through the prophets, and there's this sense in which God is like constantly saying to people, again, a lot of times it shows up in quotations, you know, it's just reiterating, like, you don't have to be afraid. You don't have to be driven by fear. Like the New Testament, one of the writers says, you know, like God has not given us, you know, basically people who are trying to become the people God created them to be. God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of a sound mind. And, you know, so there's this sense in which that spirit of fear or that sort of underlying fear that sort of drives and pulls a fear-based culture forward or backward, I guess, depending on how you look at it, it is not, that spirit of fear is not from God. And so, I mean, it seems like the first Christians were very clear about that. Like there wasn't a question of like, of, you know, being controlled by fear. Is that from God or is that an adversary to what God wants? You know, is that adversarial to what God wants for people?
And this is the opportunity that I feel like the church, the evangelical church, or just religious entities in general in the modern day are missing, the opportunity to make themselves stand out, because everything in the world is shouting at people, be afraid and be skeptical of anything that isn't telling you to be afraid of something. And everything in Judeo-Christian belief is telling you the opposite. It's telling you, don't be afraid. And anytime somebody tells you to be afraid, be skeptical. And that seems like, on breaking it down, deconstructing it, and rethinking just culture and life in general, look at every avenue, every junction, every large decision, or every big event in your life. And it seems like the correct approach is to not be afraid and to be skeptical of anything that's telling you to be afraid. Now, just being skeptical of something does not mean to be dismissive of it, right? Mm-hmm. You can be skeptical and be discerning in something. You can evaluate something and still come to the conclusion that that's something to be afraid of, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I can stand at the fence to the polar bear enclosure and not be afraid of the polar bears. And then the idea pops into my head that, you know, says that I should be afraid of jumping over the fence, and I can, you know what? Yeah, you're right. I should be afraid of jumping over the fence, you know, or if I were to jump over the fence, then I would have to be afraid of the polar bears. Right. But it seems like the street corner, if you will, that religion or faith or, you know, faith in a higher power should be standing on should be the corner of do not be afraid and be skeptical of those who are telling you to be afraid. And that's why it's maddening to me to see so much of the religious power in our country and our world take the exact opposite approach. like the one thing that they could use to further their message and further good and just general decency in the world. And they're taking the exact opposite and siding with, you know, and using fear tactics and siding with politicians of across the spectrum. You know, this isn't targeting, you know, conservatives specifically. You have plenty of liberal movements that are trying to scream at people to be afraid of things, right? And but fear mongering in general is being used to motivate people across the religious spectrum, and it seems like the opposite of what we should be doing.
Yeah, I don't disagree. I mean, it's like here's the thing though, is like, so consider this, like the first Christians, you know, they would have bought into this. I mean, it seems very clear that they were bought into this idea, into this culture of not being afraid.
But, and those dudes had some stuff to be afraid of.
Exactly. Like many of these people were people who were, who experienced great loss and suffered, you know, because of their faith. And it's not like they were even doing things that were, you know, it's not like they were trying to like suicide bomb people, right? Like they were, like some of the first Christians, I mean, part of why Christianity grew so quickly in the ancient world was because many of the Christian churches and communities started because when missionaries got to a new place, the first people that they went to were the sick and dying. And so, you know, like, people who most people would be afraid to be around because they didn't want to get sick. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or they didn't want to catch the disease that would also kill them or whatever. So like, so Christians went to those people. Those were the first people that, like, if you're trying to grow a religion, you don't go to people that are about to die. You know, you go to people that are just being born, you know, or you go to people that have power or whatever, you know, that make the decisions.
Yeah, and
the wealth.
And real quick, just because you mentioned it, to put a magnifying glass over just how skittish we have become, or just how skittish Christian culture has become. The first Christians were crucified upside down and stoned to death and martyred in horrible and terrible ways for their beliefs, right?
Yeah.
And nowadays, you can get an entire group of Christians running for pitchforks and torches just by taking Santa off of a cup. Like, you take the word Christmas out of anything, all right, and you have an entire subsect of Christianity that decides that you've declared fucking war on them. That's my one. I get one. All right. But, you know, for not specifically shouting out their holiday that, by the way, they kind of stole from what is it, the Celts? Like, so but yeah, the pagans. So, you know, just to shine the magnifying glass over just how much fear has infiltrated, you know, I would say Western society, American society, and by association, Christian society. The first Christians you're talking about here are going around to lepers and those, you know, who are sick and dying and during Jesus's ministry, criminals and prostitutes and the untouchables, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And targeting them specifically and getting beat to death over it.
Yes. So, so like, you know, this idea of do not be afraid. I mean, maybe it's less like, it's not speaking about the absence of fear, but just not being controlled by fear, because it does seem like fear is a basic human emotion or experience or whatever. I don't even know what it would be considered, but like, it is something we all experience if we are healthy individuals of a sound mind. You know, like there are things that we do legitimately experience fear about.
Absolutely.
So maybe it's not so much like not having that. It's not having that experience of fear, but not being controlled by it. I think that, you know, not letting it keep you or block you or take you a different direction than what is what God wants for you or what is best for you or what is going to help you grow and become ultimately a better version of yourself if you push through despite the fear, you know?
Fear, like anything as part of the human experience, has or any human emotion for that matter, has its place, right? That, you know, everything in our experiences has its place. And so, like any emotion, too much of fear, or not even necessarily too much, but a lack of awareness of the effects that something has on you is never good, right? And it does seem like fear is one of the things that we just kind of let run rampant. And we claim that we have this idea or this firm definition of what fear is, what somebody is when they're afraid, what a coward is, what a brave person is, right? It's in our song. It's in our theme song, the America theme song that plays at the beginning of every episode. The land of the free and the home of the brave. Like, that's it. We think we know what that means, even though we prove every day that we have no concept, we have no measure, we're not keeping track of the effect that fear has on our daily decision making, on our religious decision making, spiritual decision making, on our political affiliation and the way that we believe certain things about politics or certain things about certain groups of people. I know people who, you know, I brought up socialism earlier, kind of tongue in cheek. I know people who are scared to death of socialism, but for the life of me could not tell me what the F socialism is, right? And I'm not advocating for socialism. I'm advocating against the idea that you should be so radically afraid of something that you have no concept of what it is, because that tells me that somebody has told you to be afraid of that.
Yeah.
You know? And so we are... fear can be healthy in certain circumstances, but if we are not keeping receipts on what is making us afraid, how it's making us afraid, and why it's making us afraid, and what we're doing when we are afraid of X, Y, and Z, then just like with any other emotion or any other experience, good, bad, or anywhere in between, it's potentially harmful. If you're happy too much and you're not keeping track of what you're doing when you're happy and you're in these amazing instances of just joy and everything seems like it's going great, you're manic and you're off your rocker. You know, maybe you're under the influence of a drug. You don't know. You're not keeping track of what's providing you with this sense of overwhelming sense of everything is wonderful and I have to go, 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 do, 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 right? I said doo-doo. And so you doo-doo. Hashtag doo-doo. So being manic is not a good thing. And I think that there's a lot to be learned from the way that we perceive other things and the way that we refuse to perceive fear and how taboo a subject it is to even consider. It's almost like, I can hear the thoughts of anyone who might be listening just saying, you know, oh, well, that's silly. I know when I'm afraid of things. I know. Well, do we? I can certainly think of things in my life and beliefs that I have. And I brought up my gun ownership. I don't have a good, I can't spell out for you the reason, any reasonable explanation for why I own that gun. I know how to use that gun. I was trained how to use that gun. And somewhere along the line, I got convinced that I needed that gun. I don't have a good reason. That's fear.
Do you think that, like, let's just use that example. Do you think that by owning a gun and partially because of that being a real fear, do you think that in any way that it increases the potential for you to at some point have that experience that you're afraid of, or the potential for you to need to use a gun or feel the need to use a gun, even in some different circumstance.
My Wheel of Time homies will get, you know, you say the Dark One's name and you draw his eye. Like, if you say the Dark One's name, then he sees you. Like, that's kind of what you're describing, right?
Sure.
Is the idea that you, not necessarily via any supernatural means, but like the idea that because you're afraid of something, you're creating kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
That you are creating increased potential for that thing to happen to you.
Yeah.
I guess it just depends on how much you let that fear affect your actions, right? We've certainly seen situations where it very much seems like that is the case of what's happened. Situations where somebody buys a gun, has the gun on them, and finds themselves feeling threatened in situations that you would say the average person would not necessarily feel the need to exert excessive lethal force on another human being. Mm-hmm. There's the instance in New Mexico. I can't remember the woman's name, but you know, the meme that was going around online was she went online and was talking about how, you know, she was a responsible gun owner and she was going to own a gun, and there was nobody that could tell her that it was a bad idea for her to own a gun. And people were like, we know you and you seem a little off. Maybe you shouldn't have a gun. And then, you know, X months later or X weeks later, she's arrested for shooting at somebody during a road rage encounter. So, and, you know, of course, much less funny instances, right? Where you, I mean, I don't think any instance where somebody gets shot at is really funny necessarily, but, you know, the George Zimmerman Trayvon Martin incident, where by all intents and purposes, I mean, shoot, if we can say that we know OJ did it and got away with it, then we can say that we know that George Zimmerman went out there and was looking for a fight with that kid, and he got more than he thought he could handle. And next thing you know, this kid's dead, and he gets away with murder because he tells everybody that he was afraid. How often do we see that with police? Mm-hmm. You know, and the argument that gets, you know, the Supreme Court ruled in the 80s, and that argument gets used in every single one of these cases, that all the police officer has to do is say that he was afraid, and it gives him a license to kill. Hmm. I mean, that, talk about a real pervasive way in which fear has affected our culture, is we love and embrace and respect and support and elevate our police and our firefighters and our paramedics and our service members above all others in this country, because we believe them to be heroes and we believe them to be brave and courageous and capable of incredible acts of heroism, all of which are true. But when we give them the excuse to not be brave and to take somebody else's life, like, at what point are we taking away from them that which makes them heroic? Hmm. Or at what point are we allowing fear to take that away from them, right?
Yeah.
It's just, I mean, that's a prime example of how pervasive fear has become. It's a sickness.
Yeah, I don't disagree. Like, and maybe
is that your go-to now? Is that how you're gonna? Is that your plausible deniability when the head pastor at your church listens to this and he's like, you know, boss, I never said I agreed with him. I just said I disagree with him. That's funny.
I'm getting practice in before I run for president of the United States.
Oh man, I would vote for you. So I would vote for you three times unless they had voter ID laws, which are the only way to stop people from illegally voting. Apparently,
hands for you though. You're going to be one of my speech writers, one of my main speech writers.
Yeah. Oh, I write you words so good.
Maybe what you're getting at is part of this. I mean, maybe, you know, in the English translation, what part of what it means to have a spirit of fear, you know, like it's not so much to have the experience of fear, but to have a spirit of fear, a spirit of fear is when fear becomes more than just you know, something, an emotion that we experience, or it actually becomes the thing that drives us.
Yeah.
That it becomes commonplace or habitual, or it is the culture that we inherit, or that we inhabit, or that we perpetuate.
How about this? Fear has become comfortable.
Mm.
Fear has become comfort.
Mm.
We are most comfortable. We have the most comfort in our lives when we allow ourselves to surround ourselves with our fear, when we allow ourselves to isolate ourselves from everything, from new cultures, from new experiences, from different people, from change, from risk, from anything. When we isolate ourselves, and when we the fear keeps us comfortable. Shabow, right there, bam. If we cut like the, it seems like a lot of the really successful huge podcasts, they cut like a minute to a minute and a half clip of each pod, and they put it up on their YouTube, on their Facebook page, with like a YouTube video where they zoom in the faces of whoever's talking, and they do little animations, and they do all these little effects and everything. If we did that with this podcast, it would be me harassing everybody about their fear, you know, and how it's making them comfortable.
Can we pay somebody on Fiverr to create that video for us?
I bet we could.
Hashtag Fiverr, one of our not sponsors.
Yeah, we need. So you're up in Michigan right now. You need to find the local community college and go into the graphic design class and be like, "Yo, who wants some exposure?"
To our moms.
We're not. Whoa. Nobody's gonna be exposing themselves to my mom. So. But just walk in. There's nothing that artists love more than being paid in exposure and not dollars.
Who wants to build their portfolio?
And make me some money.
Show me the money. Woo!
So I think we've really knocked some ideas out of the park here. Do you have anything that's still pressing on this idea of fear with you?
I mean, I think I'm walking away challenged to kind of think about how my own decision making is driven by fear versus in my own feelings versus, you know, just what the facts are, and then also like just living by faith. I think that's another, you know, concept or encouragement or it comes through in the scriptures too, is to live by faith or walk by faith, or like the idea is to is to see what's possible, to see what God's preferable future is. Maybe like if God exists and God created all this, what did God hope that it would become like? And to be driven by that, to see that kind of vision and then make decisions based on that. But even in like simple things in life, like how I raise my kids, what kind of food that I eat, how I plan my work week, what I, you know, when I look at my life 5 years from now, what do I want things to look like? What do I want to have accomplished? You know, just being able to be more thoughtful about how I live from a place of faith versus fear is something that I'm feeling challenged to think more about.
I like that. I like that a lot. I think that on a similar note, one of the things that I'm challenged to, or one of the things that I would hope that anybody who was listening would be challenged to, is the simple idea that you should be skeptical of, or rather you should be more skeptical of anyone or anything that's trying to insert fear into your existence than you should be of someone trying to insert, I guess, goodness or hope or love or faith or any of those things, right? And the wisdom to see the difference between the two. Because I think one of the most effective means of controlling people, and I really don't mean this in like a crazy Pizzagate, deep state, Illuminati, lizard men bullshit kind of way. Like, I mean this in, you know, just control as in steering you in one way or another, you know, towards, you know, making a one decision versus another, you know, not a global control thing, right? Yeah. Is one of the most effective means to do that is to convince people that you're giving them love or giving them faith or giving them security or giving them kindness or giving them wealth when you're actually giving them fear.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, I can think of like real life instances, none that I want to talk about right now.
None that you want to talk about on the record. Yeah, right. Absolutely. Right.
Anytime someone is.
I will talk about all of them right now on the record, and I will stick your name on it.
Like anytime someone's saying like, "Hey, man, I just have your best interests in mind," you know, or, you know, like, "I'm just looking out for you." You know, anytime someone is making those kind of comments, you know, like on the tail end of something else, you know, some discouraging news or request or,
yeah,
you know, like anytime a relationship is making you feel discouraged, you have to ask yourself why.
Yeah.
And maybe there's things, adjustments you can make, I can make, whatever. But I mean, there are certainly relationships that drain the energy and life out of me. And then there are relationships that I have that like make me feel like I could do anything in the world and be successful and be happy and be accomplished and like anything is possible. And then there's those, again, anything those relationships that are like, that just make me feel like, what am I even doing? What is the point of this, you know, and causes me to question myself and, you know, you know, and just other things in general.
Yeah. I just think it's so, and I guess the other takeaway that I've had or the thought that I've had as we go through this and as we break this down is just, you know, we talked briefly in your reintroduction about how, the evangelical church or just religion, faith, church organizations in general are having difficulty finding their corner. And so they're trying to co-opt or hijack the culture of the day or kind of, you know, catch the tailwind of the zeitgeist into being relevant to people by using the same methods that everybody else is. Right. You know, churches are trying to go viral and I feel like the street corner that's being missed out on is, you know, or rather are that faith organizations need to be at the forefront of eliminating fear. And I think it's a real loss, and I think it's really harmful to our culture that they aren't. And, you know, you can have individual instances, and I'm not going to ask you to comment on this, you know what I mean? Like, but the, you know, certainly there are examples where organizations that are, you know, may do it right in some instances and do it wrong in others, or, you know, the individual failures. And certainly there are groups out there that are just doing amazing work in this regard. But I feel like the message of religion in general, or especially Judeo-Christian religion in general in our culture, is be afraid. Be afraid of going to hell. Be afraid of not living a life the right way. Be afraid of having your children around certain groups of people or certain elements. Be afraid of your children growing up to be failures. Be afraid of losing all your money or losing your house, or be afraid of, you know, any number of things. And I just, there's such a strong message that people need to hear in our world today that's just like, be skeptical of anybody who's telling you to be afraid. They might be right, and you may have something to fear, but we have to be discerning about who and what we allow to insert fear into our lives, because it is such a powerful motivator. It's like a drug. And if we just let anybody give us that drug, then we end up doing things and believing things and saying things and listening to people tell us things that are so far outside of our character that they make us unrecognizable to those around us.
Yeah, that's well said. I think fear has the potential to cause a person to miss out on having a more complete experience of being a human being.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably religion is sometimes gets in the way of people getting to experience the full, you know, spectrum of what it means to be a human being, and in the way that God created human beings, you know, to experience the world.
You want to hear a thought that just came into my head?
What's that?
The idea that the world was created in 7 days, this, you know, what I believe to be a metaphor used to describe the infinite boundaries of existence and science in a way that a very comparably primitive people who had little to no understanding of these things could understand.
Mm-hmm.
This idea that the world was created in 7 days, the entire universe was created in 7 days, is one of the most decidedly deliberately, or maybe not deliberately rather, harmful things to the perspective of anyone who bases their life around that particular faith.
Mm.
Because at some level, the idea that the universe was created in 7 days convinces people that their experience, their human experience, can be justifiably small.
Mm.
Are you smelling what I'm stepping in?
Yeah.
So like you're saying, like, religion, unfortunately, and, you know, maybe not by design, has been limiting to people on the things that they can experience as a human being. And I'm putting forth that people have subconsciously been believing that their experience is meant to be limited and meant to be small and meant to be compact and with managed risk and little, you know, limited contact with things outside of their own control. And confined within this 7 days, of universal creation, when it should be just all over the place. It should be everything. It should be joy, and it should be rage, and it should be anger, and it should be reckless, and it should be a little bit of fear.
Yeah, it should be quantum.
Quantum. It should be everything.
All at once.
Hashtag quantum. That's it. You should do that. Quantum. That would be a good hashtag. Like that would be, you talk about trying to make church viral. You should have like a sermon series, and you could call it like quantum faith, or, you know, the quantum life.
How about quantum leap of faith?
Quantum. No, I think that's. I think that's trademarked or whatever. It's a copyright.
Oh man, I thought that was good.
That was nice. That was nice. Yeah. a quantum leap of faith. That sounds, you know what that sounds like? That sounds like a Wheel of Fortune clue. That sounds like you would. Doesn't that seem like it would fit perfectly on a Wheel of Fortune board? It's the before and after. It's like, I'd like to buy another vowel. U. There's like a UA and then another U at the end of the word, and people are just scratching their heads, like, sorry, there's no more vowels. You have to solve the puzzle. Like, what the fuck? I don't know. Ladna, laudanum, laudanum heap of waif. Nope, I'm sorry, quantum. And it's like, oh, it's a Q? It's a Q? Are you kidding me? It's Wheel of Fortune. Nobody ever guesses Q.
Oh,
might have taken that a little far. Hashtag Wheel of Fortune, not a sponsor. Nationally syndicated game show. They're a little outside of our punching class right now.
Future guest.
Pat Sajak. Yo, Pat Sajak goes on like the Dan Le Batard show on the reg. We could get Pat Sajak.
Do you listen to Dan Le Batard?
I do. I love Le Batard.
That show is so... I don't know. It's good. It's so good. Just whoever writes their jokes, I don't know if they just come up with them on the fly or what, but
that's the thing. That's radio, man. That's live. But if you're interested, Slate, I think, did an article recently about the Le Batard show and about what's made it so popular.
I haven't read it yet, but I do want to read it.
Yeah, it's worth a look. So I fell into a YouTube hole the night before last or last night I think it was the night before last when it came out that Aaron Popovich, Greg Popovich's wife, had passed.
Yeah.
Which, you know, rest in peace. That's what a tragedy, man. Greg Popovich is like one of the best people on the planet. And anyways, I fell in a YouTube hole and, you know, Popovich isn't exactly a media friendly guy. He's quite the opposite, right?
Right.
But he is a very funny guy. He's a very loyal guy. He's a very good guy. And he had an appearance on Le Batard's show that he did kind of as a favor to Stan Van Gundy, who was on the show at the time. He was sharing anecdotes and everything. And I thought that just reminded me of it. And I just wanted to do a quick shout out, you know, to Greg Popovich, who's one of our regular listeners. You know, we're thinking about you. Yeah.
You're in our thoughts and prayers.
Hashtag Facebook prayer circle.
I kind of feel like we are the Le Batard show of
of religious podcasts. Yeah, we're the Le Batard show, except without any of the success or funding or listeners. Can I share one more brief little thing before we wrap it up here? That we're at an hour and 22 minutes, so we gotta. This has been a good long one. This podcast has been long, but not so hard. And that's, hey, whoever's listening from that church, this is your preacher laughing at that joke in the background. That's your preacher. So on Facebook, every now and then, there's, you know, the one of my favorite, least favorite things is the I'm going to guilt you into sharing this meme of something by telling you that, you know, if you don't, you know, I bet 99% of people won't repost this picture of our troops. And it's actually like a picture from Tropic Thunder, you know, or it's Willem Dafoe in Platoon, you know. And, you know, and another one of my favorites is, are you brave enough? Again, you know, the topic of fear and what people think is brave and what people think isn't brave. Sharing anything on your Facebook page, not brave. Never been brave, right? So, my favorite, if you're brave enough, are you brave enough to have Jesus on your Facebook wall? I bet 99% of you won't like and share this picture. And it's actually a picture of Ewan McGregor as Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars Episode 2.
Does this exist?
Like, this exists, and you know, for the first time in my life, I had somebody on my Facebook page share that unironically, and it made me, I feel like it was a real turning point in my life. I feel like that was the point where I looked at myself in the mirror and said, Josh, you've entered your 30s. You're officially old enough to have Facebook friends who are old enough to unironically share a picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi thinking it's a picture of Jesus Christ.
Oh my gosh. That is hilarious. Can you send me like somewhere where I can see those examples of those types of posts?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, share that with me. That
I'm gonna send that to you right after. So okay, final thought in 30 seconds or less. Preacher, go.
Fear doesn't have to be a factor.
Oh God, I want to. I used my one up already, but you know what I want to say to you. You know what I want to say to you. It's with a f and an That's it. You know what? It's it. Podcast over.
Just call it. Just hit the button.
Podcast over. Please continue.
That was all I had to say.
You didn't even have a thought. You didn't have a complete thought. You knew I was going to get so mad when I heard you say fear is not a factor. You know what? It's good to end a heavy podcast like this on a laugh, though. Seriously. I really hope that, you know, that the message here didn't sound too preachy, because I feel like I think both of us really had some vulnerable moments, right? You know?
Yeah, I agree.
You know, really kind of opened up the heart, exposed our own flaws, however few they might be.
Only just a couple.
Like I said, anyways, rethinking. We're back, baby.
Yeah.
What do you think? Once a week? Can we do once a week? Are we going to manage?
I hope so.
All right. Once a week. And...